Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Decide carefully. Ugh, that is easier said than done when it comes to the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of decisions you need to make when it comes to your money. So how do you make the right decisions, the best decisions, and how do you prevent yourself from going into full-blown crisis mode? Certified financial planner Shannon Lee Simmons wrote a book to help with that. It's called No Regret Decisions, Making Good Choices During Difficult Times. She's here to take us through it. Then the rise of online sports betting. It has become much more common these days, but there are risks, financial risks. Economics professor Moshe Lander talks about the government's current approach to gambling and how that is impacting Canadians. And have you ever added something to your cart just so you'd qualify for free shipping? Come on, you've done that. You totally have. Something you didn't necessarily need. This is one example of unconscious spending that has been highlighted in a study from FP Canada. It's called The Quiet Spend. Certified financial planner Jackie Porter is here to talk about her tips for curbing these habits. Reducing unconscious spending takes something for sure. One thing it takes is willpower. And Ramona King will be here to talk about that. She's senior finance editor at Finder. She's going to talk about the science of willpower. Plus, I'll speak to renegade boomer Tina Lorenz about something she calls the anti-retirement movement. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. In each and every stage of our lives, we have to make decisions. So many decisions about what to study, where to work, what to buy, what to sell, how to save, whether to marry, whether to divorce, whether to procreate. The volume and complexity of all of these decisions can be so overwhelming. So, certified financial planner and author Shannon Lee Simmons wrote a book to help you get through it, in particular, in crisis. This new book is called No Regret Decisions, Making Good Choices During Difficult Times. Hello there.
Hello.
Why write this book at this moment in time?
I think, well, when I started the book, it's because I noticed that, I've seen people's lives play out for 15 years on the front line of financial planning. And I started noticing a trend in people where, when they're making these big decisions and how they're playing out on the other side. And so I wanted to write the book. And now I feel very lucky, Bruce, that it came out when it did, because I think given everything that's gone on post-pandemic with inflation and interest rates and, oh my gosh, housing prices and everything, I think the average person now has been thrust into a situation where the future is super uncertain and we have to make a series of really tough decisions.
You share a really powerful story at the beginning of the book about your experience as a parent during the pandemic. And as a parent during the pandemic, I felt seen. I could relate to everything you said, the tears, the locking yourself in the bathroom, all that. You said to your toddler, quote, "It's not forever. It's just for now." We're now in the now. How do you feel now? Because I read that and I think, wow, you were right.
Yeah, but I think the next line is, I hope I didn't just lie to him. It's one of those things where I still say that to a lot of people who are in situations where everything is in flux and the future is super uncertain. And one of the pieces of wisdom that I think this job has given me is being able to see that, these are moments in our life. These are times and periods of our lives. There are hard years, but that doesn't mean it's indicative of the future forever. And it's the same, even if you think about stock market returns and volatility in the market, it's not forever. It's just for now. It's the same idea. And so I think I didn't really know at the time, but it's one of those things that you have to hold on to. I remember saying it to myself like a mantra, like, this isn't forever. This is just for now. And that allows you somehow to shrink the problem from being this overwhelming, spiraling out of control. What does this mean in the future to what am I going to make for dinner? that, you know, and we take it from huge to small. And I think when we're in these moments of whether it's a full out personal crisis or whether it's just massive decisions that need to be made where you're like looking forward thinking the stakes are so high. Yeah. Sometimes it's really helpful to just be like, it's not forever. It's just for now.
You have defined this phrase decision crisis in a, mm-hmm. in a unique way as an equation. Take yes. us through that equation.
So for me, I mean, we make decisions every day, but the ones that I'm talking about in this book and the motivation for making this book in the first place, which was pre-pandemic, was that often there are people who need to make decisions. And here's the formula where there are high financial stakes, right? So we're not talking about a decision where, you know, you're ordering a pizza or not. Yeah. And it's like, oh, it's annoying. It's high financial stakes, high emotional stakes. And what I mean by that is that once you make this decision, your life will not be the same again. No pressure. So yeah. I'm like quitting your job. You quit on Tuesday, your life on Wednesday is different.
Yeah.
Getting married or asking someone to marry, like to marry you, your life looks different the next day, depending on what they say. Either way, it's different. If you have a baby, if you retire, if you are getting a divorce, if you get diagnosed with a critical illness, like your life as you know it is different after this decision. So that's what I mean by high emotional stakes and then plus uncertainty. So you have to make decisions with no real control over how things are going to play out. So your life is going to change. It's going to cost money and you can't guarantee the future. That's scary. And this happens in our life all the time. And I get pulled into these conversations as a certified financial planner and life coach because money's involved. So people are like, you know, how much can I afford or what do I need? Or can I do this? Or can I afford this? And so these conversations I've been having for like 15 years, I don't think I could have written this book 10 years ago, Bruce. I don't. Because I didn't have the anecdotal evidence to see who's thriving on the other side and who's not.
And that evidence has been the foundation for what you call the decision crisis playbook that has a bunch of tips under it. Number one, don't make decisions in panic mode. How do you put the pause on the panic button when the ceiling's falling in?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, if everyone can kind of relate to the pandemic as being a moment where your life looks different the next day, whether you liked it or not, I mean, we can all relate to that now too. I think one of the things that's really important about not making a decision in panic mode is that to realize that like, it's not like you can just end being in panic when your life looks different or when the stakes are really high. But what you can do is acknowledge that you're in it, which I think is huge in itself. And then consciously and mindfully do things to try to pull yourself up out of it for like 2 seconds so you can just breathe and see clearly that moment of clarity, like this isn't forever, this is just for now, like just a moment of calm thoughts so that you can, when you're making decisions and when you're trying to move forward through whatever decision crisis it is that you're having, you're very mindful that it's not just a reaction to something or a default position. Those are the ones I find to be the most panic based. It's like a huge reaction or a default position, which is I was so scared, I did nothing. And then like life just happened to me. And like whatever the default is going to be basically the decision that you made by doing nothing. And I think that just even the mindfulness around not making a panic-based choice is important itself, because those are the people that I've noticed over the years where, you know, things don't work out and they look back and say, I have so much regret.
Mm. Number two in the playbook, make long-term values-based decisions. Often our values are contradictory in that we could say, I really, really, really value family and I really, really value financial prudence. A family member has passed away. The funeral is tomorrow. Do I go or don't I go?
Exactly. Discuss. Yeah. So I think I call them it's your core values, which, you know, we're all pretty familiar with that term, the things that make you, you, and they're different for you than it is for someone else. And I think really, again, going out and mapping them out, like what are some of my core values? And that's all fine and good. But then I go one step further in the playbook and it's like, what's your deciding value? And so sometimes, so if those are your two values, which is like financial prudence and also like, you know, family, those are going to be at war with each other sometimes. And so each decision that you have to make when the stakes are high and those two come into conflict with each other, You have to make a priority. You have to put one above the other. And then that's your decision and you're staking your claim to it. And if it's actually true to who you are in that moment and what's important to you in that moment, then even if you tick someone off or go into debt, depending on whatever the outcome is from that decision, you're going to look back and say, I don't regret it, because even though I love my family, I couldn't go into debt this time. I just got out of it. You know, we don't know what's going on in someone's life. In that moment, my deciding value, I prioritized my value of financial prudence over family. And on the flip side, someone else might've been like, take all my money. I'm flying to Australia for the funeral.
Yeah.
I don't care if I paid off for 800 years. I am prioritizing my value of family over that. And they're going to look back and at that debt and be like, pain in the butt, but I'm not blaming myself forever and having a sleepless night.
Number three, control what you can if you can. Number four, set boundaries or guardrails so you don't run out of time or money. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think this is my favorite one. It seems like such common sense. Everyone's like, of course, don't spend more than you want to. But it doesn't happen so mindfully when we're in that panic. So taking the time to plot out when you're going to call it is really important. So for example, a really accessible example of a pivot point versus a guardrail. Pivot point is basically like you map it out before you actually start heading along your path, where a pivot point's when plan A didn't work and you have to shift other things in your life so that you can keep going down the path. So let's have an example of, let's say you're going to buy your first house and your ideal price point is $700,000. And then you start bidding and it's like, well, it's actually, someone else has put in 750,000 and it's like, okay, well, we can do 750. It's not what we wanted, but if we do 750, then we can't renovate. So that's a pivot, right? You've pivoted your plan. Okay. So we're not going to renovate. We're going to keep going at this. But we had to change our plans in order to make this thing happen. And so we're going to decide to do that mindfully, changing up our plans. The guardrail is where it's a no more. There's no more options. There's no more ways that you can change your plans, right? Like there's no more things that can shift. And so another pivot point might be, a guardrail might be 750,000 like that, 775,000. And so you get there and not only have you pivoted the reno, not only have you pivoted where you're going to live, but now you can't get a house for under $800,000. And it's like, but if you'd set out the guardrail before, like the bank will not give you a mortgage that will allow you to buy an $800,000 house. Well, that there is a guardrail. That means that you're out of options. Like it's done. Like you can't go any further. And so sometimes you can put that guardrail into place to protect yourself. So for example, I do this with people all the time when they're buying a house. It's like, where's the number where I'm house poor? Don't go over that. So it doesn't mean that you haven't pivoted and gone over your ideal, but it means that we're not going over past this. And sometimes it can be put on you, which is like the bank won't literally give you enough money. So it's done. The dream is it's done right there. So that's the guardrail. And I think by mapping out these pivot points where it's like, I'm willing to shift my life around and make this happen versus a guardrail where it's like, I won't have regret because I didn't get myself house poor.
One last question before we go. The last part of the playbook, embrace your next normal. I love the nuance here. You did not say new normal. You said next. Why?
Correct. Because we don't know what it is just yet. And your next normal is just your day-to-day life on the other side of this decision crisis. Once the dust settles, like you played your hand. And now you see where it's going to play out, whether this is like divorce or moving or whatever, like you're eventually your day-to-day life is going to start again. And you're going to say, okay, well, this is the next normal. And I use the word next because there's going to be lots of next normals in our lives. And again, it doesn't have to be forever. It can just be for now because we can choose our way to another one if we don't like it. And when I say embracing, it's like, this book is really for people who are afraid about things not working out, because if you did the thing and it all worked out the way you wanted to, then great. Yeah. But if you did the stuff, you did all the things, and then it doesn't work out the way that you wanted it to, can you look back and not have regret? And it's really about embracing it in the sense that, okay, this isn't what I wanted, but because I don't regret the decisions that I made when I look back, I don't blame myself. And that has been the number one piece of contentment and thriving and confidence on the other side of a decision crisis that I've seen over the last 15 years. Because those who look back when they're sitting in a situation where they don't love their day-to-day life and say, you know what, I made the best choice I could at the time, they have the confidence going forward. Whereas people who regret are afraid of more bad things happening to them because they don't trust that they'll be able to handle it.
Shannon Lee Simmons, Congrats on this latest book. And thank you for joining us to talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
The book is called No Regret Decisions, Making Good Choices During Difficult Times. I don't know how many times I made that sound during this interview. Must be the trigger of my life in those early weeks of the pandemic.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Sports betting has been a thing pretty much since sports were invented. I would bet there's some archaeologist who's identified evidence of betting back thousands of years. Recently, though, in Canada, there have been some changes in the legal environment that have really increased the prominence of sports betting. In Ontario, for example, there are ads everywhere, ads that I never saw before. And sure, I'm sure for people who do it, it is fun. But getting into the habit of it can be problematic for some people in the same way as traditional gambling at the slot machines can be. So what are the risks as sports betting becomes more and more common? For more on this question, I'm joined by Moshe Lander. He is a senior lecturer in economics at Concordia University, specializing in the economics of sports, gaming, and gambling. He's in Montreal. That would have been a pretty fun dissertation, I bet.
I bet it would, yes.
Yeah.
It's a nice change. A lot of economists don't even know that this exists as an area.
How would you characterize the sports betting market here in Canada? Do we do it more than other geographies? How common is it?
I don't think anybody does it more than the Americans do, right? And if you have access to American TV, which pretty much everybody in Canada does, you can't avoid that it's everywhere. The Europeans like it, of course, for their soccer. And maybe for some sports that are secondary in nature to them. But here, you know, football is king. Canadians have this weird area because hockey isn't really a major betting market. And we're not really as into baseball, basketball, and football betting the way the Americans are. So we're kind of more on the cusp, but it's growing rapidly. That's for sure.
What are some of the economic principles that you apply to the world of sports betting? So if we were talking about the sale of bread, we would look at the intersection of the supply and demand curve. We're talking about the sale of a bet. People are paying to participate in that as a game. What are some of the principles that apply as you look at this world?
So there's one overriding principle that actually comes from the world of finance, and that's the idea of the efficient market hypothesis. Okay. And so this is the idea that as long as you're not doing something like insider trading, and that puts you in the Martha Stewart wing of prison, you should find that there's complete information embedded in the price of a share. So if there's some sort of public information that's out there that's not embedded in that price of a share, somebody would come along and arbitrage away that profit or loss, right? Mm-hmm. Same sort of thing then should exist within sports betting. If everybody out there has the same access to information, if you don't have secrets about who's injured, not injured, who's going to play tonight and who's not going to play tonight, then when you see something like a point spread or an over under, that should reflect all available information. And so really what it reduces your bet to is not much more than a 50-50 coin toss as to how it's going to play out. Because if it were anything other than 50-50, you would expect that you'd see a lot of money push on one side or the other, and that would change the line and that would make it efficient. So there's this belief then that especially for very, very liquid markets where there's a lot of money gambled, you're really reducing your bet to really just a flip of a coin. And that's kind of a depressing idea if you get a lot of dopamine out of gambling.
What is the factor that having a middle person brings to this? Because if it was just me versus you, we would make a bet and we would exchange money. I would win inevitably. And you just give me your money. But when there is a middle person, they're taking margin here. And that would affect the equation in some way, surely.
Sure. So if you put in a middle person at that point, then, and I completely agree that if we gambled, you would win.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is the middle person says, how about the following? How about I take a dollar from each of you, and whichever one of you wins, I'm going to give you the $2. But I want each of you to deposit 10 cents with me as a penalty fee for whichever one of you loses. The one that wins, I'll give you back the 10 cents, but the one that loses, I'm going to keep that. That's called the VIG or the vigorish. Mm-hmm. And so that's the role that, say, like Vegas would play. That's the role that here in Canada, the government is playing as the middle person. That's the role that the bookmaker on the dorm floor plays. And so they inevitably want to try and create this balanced betting that they're getting $1 from each of us. And that way they can go to bed at night knowing for sure that they're going to make their 10 cents and they don't have to worry about this imbalanced sort of betting where they're going to have to pull out of their own cash. And so if they've done the efficient market hypothesis idea really well, they're going to make a lot of money that way. And to some extent, that's why Vegas is Vegas and you and I are not.
Yeah. What do you know? What does the market know about who is doing the betting? Are there skews demographically in terms of age, gender, income?
So for sure, the overwhelming number of gamblers out there are men. And that's probably because men are more likely to be watching the sports. And that means that if they want to get involved in the action and they can't play themselves, then they're going to gamble on it. It gives them that extra boost for watching. The income distribution is probably more towards middle to lower income Canadians than it is at the high end. But if high income Canadians are participating, they're likely to be gambling a lot in dollar terms. But as a percentage of their income, it's a smaller proportion, right? So if my income is 10 times yours, but I'm only gambling two times what you are, in dollar terms, I'm gambling more, but as a percentage of my income, I'm gambling less. And so it tends to mean then that it's that meaty middle of the distribution to the lower end that's making up the volume of bets that we're seeing.
As a person whose life's work is focused on personal finance, which is really where I've spent my whole career, any sort of gambling or betting makes my my hair go on end. What are the risks from an economist, from an economic perspective, that you would flag here for individuals?
You could lose. It's as simple as that, right? Like you're basically taking
repeatedly over and over and over.
And on something for which you have zero control. So you can pore over all of the data, you can look at all of the history, you can talk to experts and whatever it is that you want to do. But at the end of the day, the moment that the game is being played, unless you're prepared to go Tonya Harding on somebody and kneecap a player to influence an outcome, you're on the sidelines here. And so that type of situation then is you should never, ever be betting on an amount that you're not prepared to lose. If you win, awesome, but you should treat it then as nothing more than, you know, you go to the movie and you're parting with your money and you just hope that the movie is good. You better be prepared to part with your money here and just hope that somehow your team covers the spread or you get the over or whatever it is that you're betting on and you get your money back. That should be seen as a bonus, not some sort of lifestyle decision of how you're going to make ends meet.
There is government, if not intervention, there's a government role in other air quotes vice categories, alcohol with tax, cigarettes with tax. What role should the government have in engaging on online sports betting in particular?
So that, I guess, depends on where your politics are, right? There's certainly going to be people out there who say you shouldn't have any limit put on there, right? Sugary drinks are unhealthy. Coffee is unhealthy, yet we don't have any restrictions that are placed on how much you can consume. And in fact, those types of things can make you a burden onto the healthcare system in later life, right? There are people from the other end who would say that, you know, the thought of legalizing marijuana was difficult enough to swallow, but the thought of legalizing cocaine and heroin is a non-starter, right? So gambling probably fits somewhere in that distribution, but it really does depend on where do you see the role of the government in creating that nanny state of telling you what you can and can't do with your money. And the other aspect is, if you lose your money, who are you hurting, right? You're a parent with lots of children, and unfortunately we can't eat this week. Yeah, maybe you need some sort of reining in. If you're living a single life and you can afford to lose that money, should you be told that you have a limit to how much you can gamble? Yeah.
One last question before we go here. What is an example of a question that researchers are trying to answer when it comes to sports betting? As we look, you know, to the next 5 or 10 years, what are people thinking about that come to this industry from an academic or a research perspective, as distinct from driving volume, because this is a website that you run to make a profit?
So I've always been fascinated by the idea of the hot hand. Is there this phenomenon that somebody can be on fire? And so that can be an athlete themselves, or it could be a bettor who just says, you know, like at the craps table, that just everything's going my way. Is that something that you can psychologically influence, or is that just random luck, right? I could flip a coin 10 times in a row and conceivably it could land on heads. Did I will it to happen, or was that just dumb luck? That could really influence the way that people see betting then. If what you're watching is something that is controllable from either the athlete standpoint, the coach's standpoint, or the bettor themselves, as opposed to just a random opportunity here, I think that's going to influence the way that we see gambling then going forward. And I think that that might answer your earlier question of what role does the government have then, if this really is just an exercise in coin flipping.
Really interesting stuff. Moshe, thank you for joining us today.
Anytime.
Moshe Lander is a senior lecturer in economics at Concordia University. He joined us today from Montreal to talk about sports betting from an economics perspective. Stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, a survey from FP Canada looks at unconscious spending habits. We'll talk to certified financial planner Jackie Porter about what that survey identified in terms of trends. And later, the renegade boomer. Tina Lorenz is here to talk about the anti-retirement movement. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can catch up at moolala.ca or go to any of the podcast platforms out there, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Music, Amazon Prime, whatever. If you go to one of those platforms, download the show, write a review, come on, do it, and subscribe to the podcast so the next episode just shows up right on your device.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Do you ever see a charge for a monthly subscription on your credit card bill and wonder, like, did I sign up for that? What is that doing there? I don't remember. That is just one of many examples of unconscious spending. A survey from FP Canada called The Quiet Spend found that many, many of Canadians' dollars are going towards purchases like that we're just not, we don't remember making, we didn't make with any intention. And how do you curb that behavior? How to change unconscious habits? Certified financial planner Jackie Porter joins us now with some tips. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. So happy to see you again.
How happy to see you. How would you define or characterize what you mean when you talk about unconscious spending habits?
You know, I would actually equate it to, it's the new year and I'm in the midst of a diet trying to fit back into my pre-pandemic clothes. And I think the quiet spend is very much like unconscious eating, right? You know, sometimes people eat to self-soothe. Sometimes we spend to self-soothe. And I think it's these unconscious spending habits where you're, you know, buying things at the counter just because they're on sale. Next thing you know, we put it in our, you know, our cart and off we go. Or we're, you know, buying things at the checkout online. So all of a sudden they're like, only 80 more bucks to free shipping. Woo! We're spending $80 more we didn't plan to spend. And there you go. There goes the cash. Or it could just be, you know, you started to listen to a streaming site and, you know, after a few listens, they're like, sign up. You only get to hear a few notes. And then they're like, sign up. So you sign up and listen to that favorite song. And then you forgot you set up your credit card to auto withdraw from your credit card. And then things fall apart.
Now, this survey outlines a whole bunch of unconscious spending types, many that are super familiar, like using a credit card to make payments, and then some that are a bit more like, wait a second, have you been looking over my shoulder? And the one that I want to have you speak a little bit about is adding additional to get a perk, like free shipping, or maybe it's a buy one, get one, or whatever. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, I think it's kind of going back to that whole thing of, you know, you're being incentivized to do something you weren't planning, you didn't have in your budget if you have one, or, you know, all of a sudden you're buying things that you didn't even really need. Maybe by the time this, you know, chew toy comes for your dog to the house, it's like the dog's moved on. Like it's not even something it needs or wants, right? So you're really being incentivized by that retailer to pay money, pay more money, buy more things. And, you know, that's your reason to get free shipping or get an additional perk. And it's kind of something that you do. You don't think too much about it. It's kind of like, you know, you go into a store and you see that big red sale sign. And then all of a sudden you feel motivated to buy something, even though you didn't go into that store. Maybe you thought you were just going to go in to browse. Yeah. Now you're at the checkout. So I think it's those unconscious habits. It's kind of going back to, you know, you're on a diet. Like I said, this is where I'm at right now.
Clearly, lived experience at the fore.
So you kind of are on this diet, and then you've got cookies in the house. Bad idea if you're on a diet. And the next thing you know, you're taking the cookies, you're watching TV mindlessly, and you're eating cookies mindlessly. That wasn't a part of the plan. And there's
now,
cost to that.
Sure. In this survey, they rank these unconscious spending types according to the percentage of respondents who think they're going to do that more frequently in the year ahead. And the first one is using a credit card to make payments. And I'm going to ask you just for your gut check here. How much of this is because people aren't conscious? And how much of the reliance on credit cards is a function of the world we find ourselves in today with, you know, things just being so expensive?
Yeah, you know, I think there's probably some medium in there. And I think even with the pandemic, people are getting just more used to using debit or credit cards than they ever have before. And then the other part of it, as you said, is things are costing more. So, you know, I think one of the survey results that I thought was interesting is millennials are the biggest indebted group right now, right? And they're also using credit cards to pay for things, largely because they may not have the cash on hand. And another part of it too is they might not have the experience that we've had if we've had to carry a balance on a credit card. And anybody who's done that remembers how long it takes to pay that thing off.
Yeah. What do you think Canadians could do, should do, to curb their unconscious spending habits?
I think the first thing is cancel those cards. Maybe not cancel them, get a replacement card. I think that's a great place to start. Get a replacement card with a brand new number so that those expenses that would, like, especially the subscription ones, you can kind of just get a clean slate because you'd have to intentionally go back and resubscribe to all of those services. So that's a great way to just get rid of some of those monthly subscription costs that are, since we're talking about dieting, eating away at your financial plans. You know what I mean? So I think that's a good place to start. I think also just nothing excites people, I feel, more than having goals. And sleeping better means knowing where you stand financially. So this is a good time of the year to check in with yourself, ask yourself if you actually have a spending plan. Nothing wrong with having a spending plan. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with splurging on some of those things that you want. But ask yourself if you know where you're at financially, because that's the hardest part of quiet spending. It's really spending money that you don't know you don't have. And then worrying about it, having those sleepless nights, thinking about how you're going to pay that credit card, because you made that spend without knowing where the money was going to come from to pay that credit card bill off.
This survey comes from FP Canada, as I mentioned. You are a certified financial planner. And still in Canada, the lion's share of the work done by financial planners isn't in the realm of cash flow. Like many, many, not all, but many, many CFPs work in the realm of investing principally. That's and right. They have a, like, they're not compensated to get really into the detail on a family budget. How, for individuals, do you think they can advocate for themselves in working with a financial planner such that that is where the value is added? Because I think the default, and you can argue with me on this, but I think the default is that it's investing first and not cash flow.
Yeah. And I think you should ask the planner what their specialty is, like, and be really transparent about what you're seeking a planner to do. We've certainly had people who've approached my team, ask me, you know, am I going to just get an investment recommendation? Are we going to do a plan? I think if you're working with a planner that doesn't, you know, potentially charge, because you know, doing a family budget, doing a plan, there might be fees associated with it, but you get what you pay for,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So working with someone where you know they're going to focus on a priority, especially if you want to start the new year right, and you're really trying to put yourself in a better financial, like a healthier financial position. Like, ask what the advisor, first of all, they might not have a CFP. Maybe they don't have a CFP credential. So I am going to push back on you, Bruce, because often people who might hold themselves out to be a financial advisor, that doesn't mean they have a CFP designation that they can help people with things like cash flow management. So just ask what designations your advisor has. Do they work in the areas of specialty cash flow? It's really going down to a matter of what do you need for the advisor to help you with, and really make sure that they tell you what their process is and how they're going to help you with these issues.
Jackie Porter, thank you very much.
Such a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Jackie Porter, certified financial planner. She was here to talk about FP Canada's quiet spend survey. Some shocking numbers about how frequent our unconscious spending habits can be and may well be into the future.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, Tina Lorenz calls herself the Renegade Boomer, and she's going to be here to talk about why she chose to forego retirement, stay working, and how she works with other people of a certain age to do the same. But first, why willpower alone will not stop you from impulse spending. Ramona King is the senior finance editor at Finder. She joins us to talk about the science of willpower. I am also the money columnist for CBC Radio, so every Wednesday afternoon, we dig into a topic relevant to you, relevant to your financial life. So wherever you are in this country, from coast to coast to coast, tune the dial in Wednesday afternoon, and we'll have a natter there too.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I have almost no willpower when it comes to treats. Not like zero, but close to zero. There is a package of 2-bite brownies in my kitchen right now, and it will take every single ounce of willpower I have to stop myself from consuming all of them by 10 p.m., like every single one of them. I just can't have them in my house. Many, many people deal with a similar challenge when it comes to their spending. Like, they have to summon all of their willpower to prevent themselves from spending on things that they don't really, really need. And relying on willpower really just isn't enough. Our next guest says that willpower is in part, maybe large part, a biological process, and we need to stop relying on it when it comes to our money. Ramona King is the senior finance editor of Finder, and she joins us from Vancouver, British Columbia. Hello there.
So good to be here, Bruce.
Great to have you back. When you hear the word willpower, how do you define it? What does it mean to you?
Oh, I mean, I was like you. I thought I had to muster every ounce of every willpower. It came from my mind and I could just will myself into doing or not doing something. And then I would get a bag of mango. My thing is dried mango from Costco. And in 2 days, I would eat the whole bag.
Yes.
My husband looks at me and goes, how are you not like sick to your comatose stomach? I don't understand. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And so I don't have it in my house. I cannot buy it. It cannot be in my house. I will actually sniff it out. It's so bad. So based on this and based on what I observed in myself, which is why do I have such great willpower when it comes to my finances, until that one or two times I'm buying gifts out of the year. And then next thing you know, I'm $1,000 over budget. And I'm like, why? I'm great. I started looking at willpower and just what it meant. And I realized that, unbeknownst to me, really smart people have been studying this for a long time. And they've come up with this theory, which there's a lot of credibility and a lot of studies behind it, saying willpower isn't just a mental process, which was a shocker to me.
Yeah. So when we use the phrase a biological process versus just a mental process, what does that mean?
So I've come down to like really short notes, cheat notes. It's there's a biological process that happens in my body where hormones get released that help me say no to something or yes to something. Yes to exercise, no to that chocolate bar. But I only have a certain amount of that hormone. I only have a certain supply of it. And if I keep using it, then it gets depleted. So I can start the day with a full glass and then end the day with an empty glass. Now, here's the problem. It's not just when I use the willpower. It's stress. It's lack of sleep. It's all the other stuff I throw onto my body and to my day that helps deplete that hormone and means that I don't have it in stock for when I need it to say no to something. And so that becomes a problem if I go to the grocery store and I'm hungry. Everyone kind of knows this. And all of a sudden that, you know, $40 grocery cart that I wanted becomes $140 because I have all these impulse. Oh, I need this. Oh, that looks good. That's on sale. And that's how I blow my budget.
Well, it also makes me think of the tasks that we have to do to keep a handle on our money, like, I don't know, balancing our checkbook or filing our taxes or all that, all those sorts of things. It sounds like one of the things we should be doing is doing those when we wake up in the morning, because we have at least a hope of having some of that hormone coursing through our body.
See, that's a really good observation. I actually started doing that. I started paying the bills first thing in the morning on certain mornings. I'd get up a little bit earlier for that reason, because I have willpower, shall we say, to actually do the boring things, pay the utility bill, than to go out and buy that nice new sweater. And so, or even to just, you know, watch a Netflix show. So I think there is some validity to that. But I think that there's things that we need to sort of put into place on a day-to-day basis or on a moment-by-moment basis that'll help us in the long run, in particular because science is showing us that the impulsive part, the part that sort of we think is willpower, that's the day-to-day short-term stuff. And that's what gets us in trouble. And the long-term stuff, the expansive stuff, the long-term goals, the goal setting, all that stuff, that's the stuff that suffers because our impulsive part of our brain takes over.
So what are some other tactics that we could employ such that we were less reliant on that limited amount of willpower hormone?
You want to start with the frontal cortex, the expansive, long term goal planning part of our brain, to actually set our intentions and understand what our goal is. So we start there. Okay, I want to, you know, we did a survey of Canadians and they said 55% said, I want to save money. That's my goal for this year. So you set that expansive intention. And then the impulsive part of your brain, the brain that we rely on for willpower, those are the hacks that we have to think about. So some of the hacks that we looked at were, hey, why don't we use the 24-hour rule? I use this on my kids a lot. If you really love it and you really want it, tomorrow, 24 hours later, we'll come back and get it. So it's that idea that I have to postpone any purchase that's not pre-planned and part of a goal for 24 hours before I can buy it. And if I postpone 24 hours, I might have more resources in my willpower stock to say no to something that's not as important as that long-term expansive goal.
What do your kids say when you evoke the 24-hour rule?
Well, they're really good at it now because they'll say things like, oh, okay, Yeah, we'll wait 24 hours. And then I'll actually check in with them a little bit later. Hey, you know that Nerf gun you really, really wanted? How are you thinking about it now? Oh, I'm not so sure. And we actually recently did this. They did end up buying a Nerf gun that they really wanted, but they actually ended up waiting 1 week. And that's part of building that willpower resource. It's understanding how to delay your gratification without thinking that you have to rely on that willpower solely and only, right?
There are scientists, as we say, who've been studying this. Is there any hope that there is a supplement that Jameson can market that will give me more willpower?
Oh, you know, if they had, I would have bought all of it by now, Bruce, and it would all be in my, but you know, and there are things we can do. Eating well is something that's really important. The other thing that I found out was, you know, there's a health psychologist from Stanford, Kelly McGonigal. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. Mm-hmm. And she actually found that there's three things, processes we can do to get into that frontal or expansive, long-term objective part of our brain. One of it is vigorous exercise. So if you're going to go out to the mall, go for a run first.
Wow.
Right? Adequate sleep. I don't ever think I've ever heard someone say, I'm going to take a quick nap before I go grocery shopping. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's a good strategy, making sure we're rested. And mindful meditation or mindfulness meditation, taking 10 minutes in the parking lot before we have to go out and spend money, or taking 10 minutes before we're looking at that budget, just to deep breathe and center ourselves and become calm within. Exactly. Suddenly it's like, well, I can look at my budget and say, you know what? Netflix and Disney and Crave, one of them can go, and I can put that money towards a bigger long-term goal like retirement or saving for my kids', you know, financial future with their education.
I want to finish with one that, you know, we talk about on the show all the time, and that is carrying cash, using cash for small purchases. How does that connect to willpower as science?
Well, I mean, I'm one of those people that I'm not an all or nothing person anymore. I used to be like that, where I was like, you know, I make all good decisions or no good decisions. And I'm trying to teach my kids that that's impossible, that I have to allow myself to make those mistakes or not to be perfect and then learn from them. But how do I do that from a financial perspective? Well, if I know I'm an impulsive shopper, why don't I actually set myself a goal of saying, hey, I've got $100 in my wallet. In 1 month, I can spend that $100 any way I want. Don't have to worry about it. No impulse control at all. But once it's gone, it's gone. And so if I want to buy that, you know, pack of gum that I didn't have on my grocery list, then I can buy that pack of gum, but it's going to be in cash. And the other sort of adjunct to that is, hey, if you can't carry cash or it doesn't work with your, you know, lifestyle, you know, during COVID, nobody took cash. We all did. Create a cashless version of the cash jars by setting up accounts. Set up multiple savings accounts so that you can put your retirement fund in one, your kids' education fund in another, your family vacation fund in another, the car payment that you're the ultimate car you want in another. That's a form of setting aside cash or cash jars to make sure that you get into the habit of doing those savings so that what you're spending is really just the money that you have on hand.
Fascinating stuff. Romana, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce. It's a pleasure.
Romana King, the senior finance editor of Finder. She joined us to talk about the science of willpower, and she is definitely going to pursue the creation of a supplement that she will sell only to me to increase my level of willpower, in particular on the two bite brownies. Stay with us. Coming up, maybe you don't want to retire. You hear all this retirement stuff. You don't want to. You are not alone. The renegade boomer, Tina Lorenz, will be here to talk about the anti-retirement movement. We have a newsletter at Moolala. You can find it at moolala.ca. It's a once a month thing, but it brings together what we are doing here on SiriusXM, what I'm doing on CBC Radio, Cityline, BNN, Bloomberg, blah, blah, blah. So just go to do that. We won't do anything with your email address other than send you that newsletter.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery. on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You might be one of those people TikToking and counting down the days to retirement. I was talking to a teacher friend the other day, and she just did her pension update, and she knows the precise day, practically the precise time in which she will be retired. But a growing number of boomers are choosing to remain in the workforce, and not just because they want to save more money. They actually like to work. Tina Lorenz is a big believer in something she calls the anti-retirement movement. She calls herself a renegade boomer, and she joins us now from Tucson, Arizona. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce, I'm happy to join you. Sorry that you're in the snow, land of snow, but
it's okay. It's okay. We're Canadian. We live in it.
Okay.
Give me the essence of your story here. Have you decided to forego retirement, or did you try it, not like it, and return?
Well, it's actually not quite either of those, because I didn't actually start what I'm doing online until I was already past 50. So at a point where other people were talking about their early retirements, I was just getting started. So I've actually walked this pathway myself. I'm still on it. I always say, don't do the math when I say how long I've been online. But then on the other hand, own your age, you know? Yeah. And so really what I do is I catalyze inspired and a retirement second chapter strategies for accomplished professionals who are already past 50, because that's what I did.
Yeah.
And that's how it all began.
So tell us more about this phrase, the anti-retirement movement. What does it mean to you?
What it means to me is really, especially for people that have been in professional capacity already in their life, already had accomplishments, but they're reaching that age of like, well, I don't want to really do what I've been doing, but I don't know what to do next. And they're not ready to just go sit on the beach and do absolutely nothing. I mean, it's absolutely fine to build that in to your quote retirement years, if you want to call them that. I almost feel like the term should be banished from the vocabulary, because it's just a transitional time. And so what I want to do is, and what I do is help my clients find that pathway, because it may be completely different from what they've been doing. A lot of times they've lost their identity because they've just been absorbed into a corporate structure and become what was expected of them. They don't even know anymore who that is, or they have a completely different idea of something, some impact they want to make, something else they want to do. And it might be about making money, but it may be completely beyond that because they've already made the money. But there's something still they need to do, something they feel called to. And so I help my clients step into their power. I work with leaders at the forefront of transformation and light that pathway for them. So this takes all different types of forms, but for me, it's blending both of this time of your life with some of the things you've done before, but really creating, co-creating your ideal future that way.
Tell me about your process. What are the questions that you would ask with a client to help them walk down this path?
Well, I start by asking, what is it they have that dream? What is it they are looking to accomplish? What is it that's missing or they're feeling uncertain about? And then we start peeling back the layers. I work them in a very bespoke, individualized way. So it's not, I don't have a script of exactly what I ask them, because I also believe that there is a higher power at work, kind of that universal intelligence that comes through me as well. And I have almost 20 years of online experience, marketing, strategy. I was a freelance copywriter for almost 2 decades. I've helped build multi-million dollar businesses for many, many people. So I bring all of that to the table as well when they need that marketing pathway, but also it's really more than that. And all of my programs, it's always been a huge component of the mindset work, the work of how our brain works, and also tapping into a universal divine source and guide outside of ourselves. And so I blend these into really concrete marketing strategies, and together we find that pathway for them.
Can you talk a bit about what some of the barriers are for people that you see as most common? So if I were to lob one out there, it's this sense of identity that people who have worked for their whole career, maybe it's been a big, big job, maybe it's been high profile, and that as they look to this next chapter, whatever it is, they may need to grieve the loss of that particular identity. What would be some of the most common barriers that you see? And maybe barriers isn't the right word. Maybe it's hurdles. Maybe it's, I don't know how you'd describe it.
I think just common themes, I call them patterns of thought, like our old stories we tell ourselves. And so sometimes it's not even grieving that change of identity. It might even be celebrating that change of identity. So I would say the word fear comes into it. I don't, we unwrap that word too when I work with my clients, but that they might identify that as fear of the unknown, fear of going into something new, fear of leaving what they're, what's so familiar, because the way our brains work is that that old familiar way of thinking can feel, quote, comfortable, even if it's limiting us. And I don't care if you've made multiple millions and billions of dollars, you may still find that there's a limitation thinking you are, quote, supposed to be a certain way. I think the other fear is changing relationships with those near and dear to them, people seeing them in a different way. There's so many layers to this that go beyond the obvious. And that's what we work on, is those things that are beyond the obvious, but then suddenly become remarkably simple in a way, not necessarily easy all the time, but simple to start making that transition. Can I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. Can you give me an example, obviously no names, but an example right. of someone who you've worked with who came to a surprising new future for themselves?
Oh, yes, so many. Honestly, so many. Because especially when in teaching marketing and strategy, which is also something I did more on that side of things for a large portion of my career, where they thought that they were here to learn something about marketing and strategy, like how to write the profound copy, how they're going to get more sales, how they're going to attract clients. But in the process of our work together, it starts revealing there's really a deeper dream or a deeper calling that they have been pushing to the side. And one in particular thought that that's what she would be doing, is doing this higher level work with clients. And it ended up that she had started painting for herself, and then started helping other people learn to paint as almost a therapeutic process during a grieving time through the loss of her partner. And through that process, she and as we worked together, she realized that's really what she wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so it became a whole new dimension of what she was going to do. She'd worked in government for decades, and instead she started teaching people how to paint, and she started creating artwork of her own that she was selling. So it can just open entirely new doors from what you might have thought you were going to be doing.
How do you weave in the financial reality? Because I can imagine that there could be a pitfall where you have this extraordinary coaching conversation with someone, they're going to leave whatever they did and they're going to become a painter and it's amazing. But if you don't have the cash flow and the nest egg awareness, you may inadvertently coach them to financial ruin because they're just not in a situation in which they can afford to make such a significant departure from what they have done before.
That's absolutely a reality for many. Now, I happen to work with people at a very high financial level that's not usually an issue for, but when I started with nothing, right? When I started my new career past 50, I had actually been homeless in my 40s, Bruce. And wow. So, and I had no college education, I had no previous experience. I had never written anything for anyone, never been paid to write anything, a word, except if you want to count being a secretary, which I hated, by the way, when I did that work. But I made a decision that I was going to equip myself to become a freelance copywriter. And in my first year, I made multiple six figures. Now, I also believe that when you want to move forward, you need to be resourceful. What are you willing to do to achieve the dream or the goal that you have? So that's part of it. What are you willing to do? In my case, I was living in an old beat up mobile home in Arizona and we sold it. So I'm not saying everybody should sell their house, but I am saying you can become resourceful of how you're going to fund a future endeavor that you have or learning something new. The other thing is, if you have a source of income, the kind of way you make your money, don't just cut it off. Don't just burn all the ships, right? Mm. And so if you could work part-time, if you're retiring with a pension or Social Security, whatever it may be, adjusting so that you can fit in the new pathway, not saying it's going to be overnight money for you. And also just be willing to do what it takes to do the thing, to become that person. And so that may mean moving out of what we would consider our comfort zones into putting yourself out there in other ways that are still truly you, because the authenticity of this needs to come through as well, but not being afraid, not letting fear hold you back from actually starting to talk about what you're doing so that you start drawing in the people who would be interested in what you have. And so there's a way to balance this out, you know, and I would never advocate anybody, you know, a mortgage off their first child or anything like that to be able to fulfill the dream. So I think, you know, the balance of that, of not putting yourself in financial jeopardy, is also very important.
Tina, I wish we had more time. We'll have to have a future conversation, but I'm grateful that you gave us some time today.
Oh, I love being here. I wish we had more time as well. We could talk about this for hours, but thank you so much for having me here today, Bruce. I hope this has been helpful to even one person who's heard our message today.
We will meet again. Tina Lorenz, the renegade mover, the renegade boomer. Well, she's moving and grooving as a boomer.
That's true. That's very true.
And the founder of the anti-retirement movement. And, you know, we need to be having more conversations about what retirement can look like and even whether or not that term itself deserves to be retired. That is our show for today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. To reach us /me, very simple, email ask@moolala.ca, moolala.ca. Send us your comments, questions, story ideas, feedback, retirement dreams. Our newsletter is at moolala.ca. You can subscribe to the podcast anywhere on social. I'm at Bruce Selry Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening. Retired, still working, whatever you're up to, have a great day.